The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, so it's time for our weekly get-together with Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I am with you, yes. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much. Here
we are at the end of 2024.
Absolutely, yes. New Year's Eve. Yeah. New Year's Eve. It is a minute past 10 over here in London in the UK, making it a minute past midday over in Cape Town, South Africa, where Peter is. And before I go back to Peter with the topic for today's show, this is going to be our last show live on RadioSoapbox.com. For any of you who listened to the Limey show on Saturday, I mentioned that that show was ending, and I'm now moving to a more podcast based output and not essentially filling 1 hour slots on radio. So that would have left only this 1 hour slot, and as Peter is away anyway for the next 3 weeks, he'll be back on the last Tuesday of the month. It's his Great Commission course, so please keep Peter and Frontline Fellowship in your prayers for that great annual event. It seemed like a good time to go to Radio Soapbox and say that this will be our last live show, and I want to thank all the people over there for the opportunity they've given us. We've been on since the start, and we wish RadioSoapbox.com all the best for the future. So that being said, the topic Peter has got for us today is very timely, as he only passed yesterday, I believe. The real story of Jimmy Carter's disastrous foreign policy legacy. So Peter, where would you like to start us off with today's topic?
Well, Andrew, the passing away of President Jimmy Carter at 100 years old make him the longest surviving president in American history. He's the longest lived, the first to reach 100 years of age. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. You wonder how they do it. Most normal people don't live that long. But the passing away of Jimmy Carter has led to many considering his presidential legacy. And Joe Biden, unsurprisingly, claimed President Carter was a role model. Well, it is evident that Carter must have been a role model to Biden. They've both been awful presidents. And others have declared that Jimmy Carter was a champion of peace, human rights, and justice, and that he globalized the human rights movement. And I actually think that last comment's accurate. He did globalize the human rights movement. And President Ronald Reagan pointed out that Jimmy Carter's foreign policy was hypocritical. He targeted American allies who, after all, were being accused of being authoritarian and infringing on human rights, but they were being accused of this in the middle of wars while they were fighting for their lives to protect the countries from communist aggression. And yet, while Jimmy Carter would attack American allies like Nicaragua or Iran of infringing on human rights and being authoritarian and Rhodesia, we were fighting for our lives and we were being targeted by communist terrorists, and he was maintaining friendly relations with the Soviet Union and channeling vast amounts of US aid to these most totalitarian governments on earth, the Soviet Union and Red China, by the way, where there was no respect for human rights at all. So what a hypocrite. If human rights and justice and peace was the goal of his foreign policy, why is it that in every single case, without exception, every single case that he intervened and betrayed American allies, the situation got vastly, vastly worse. I mean, just consider Iran today versus Iran back under the Shah, or Zimbabwe today versus what Rhodesia was under Ian Smith, or what Nicaragua was before they were betrayed by the American allies. But so what a hypocrite, what a failed presidency. And in Africa, we do not see Jimmy Carter as a force for peace or human rights or justice at all. Jonas Savimbi of UNITA Freedom Fighter Movement in Angola is a good friend, and we visited there and ministered there many a time. And referring to President Carter, Jonas Savimbi once shocked the American guest I'd brought there. We were having a breakfast at Jumba, his capital, and Kawanda Kabongo province. And Jonas Savimbi said, "It is better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you are America's enemy, you will probably be bought. But if you're America's friend, you will certainly be sold." Now, he wasn't anti-American at all. He was just stating a fact out of sadness. He quoted positively from American founding fathers like George Washington, and he was continually referring to Thomas Jefferson and principles from the U.S. Constitution and so on. He was not anti-American. But it's better to be America's enemy than America's friend. And Jimmy Carter's policy was betray our allies and support our enemies. And Jonas Savimbi also made another joke, also relating to Jimmy Carter years. He said, "Do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America in over 200 years? America was just celebrating the 200th anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence in 1776. So 1976, he made this joke. "Do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America in over 200 years? And my American guest all sounds and looking confused. And he said, "There's no American embassy in America." And all the Africans were laughing and the Americans were looking around puzzled, because Africans know that the American embassy is often where the revolutions begin. They are hotbeds of terrorism and revolution and very subversive. And we know that also from Rhodesia, the Americans were doing so much to undermine us and support the communist terrorists who were attacking us. Well, the Shah of Iran, in his book, The Shah's Story, testifies of the treachery of Jimmy Carter's State Department. President Reagan stated repeatedly it was America's misguided policies in Iran that caused the fall of the late Shah, and called it an historic stain in American history. Despite the Shah's 37 years alliance with the United States being America's most reliable ally in the Middle East, major stabilizing force in the Middle East, and also a counter to the Soviet Union, with whom they shared a long border too. And Jimmy Carter effectively undermined the Tsar. And this is recorded in Ronald Reagan's speeches, and also George Bush in a speech in 1979 pointed this out too, that it was Carter who undermined and who betrayed the Shah of Iran, a very good American ally. And the key way how he did this, and Richard Nixon had this published in Politique Internationale in the spring of 1981, that Carter dispatched General Haig to Iran at a key time in 79 when they were facing revolution. And it was a General Haig who persuaded the Shah to incapacitate his military. The Iranian military, which was super powerful, very effective, well-trained, highly motivated, they could have crushed the Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic revolution that he was really mobilizing at that time. But it was General Haig who, with lies and twisted logic, promised American aid that never came, gave false information, whereas he knew about the serious threat of this revolution. And General Haig absolutely incapacitated, to use different terms, they castrated the Iranian military, handcuffed them, debilitated them, made them under such restrictions. And the Shah, trusting his American ally, which he later regretted greatly. And in fact, even that Carter later admitted that he followed the duplicitous advice of his ambassador, Sullivan, who was a sympathizer of these revolutionary forces. Carter's own memoirs, published in 1982, on page 443, for those who want to check, actually said he shouldn't have followed the advice of this duplicitous Ambassador Sullivan. Ambassador Sullivan was playing a double game and was actually undermining the Iranian government of the Shah of Iran and very pro the revolutionary forces. Well, American officials later condemned Carter's policies also is deceitful. And for example, Schumer in 1980, he published that Jimmy Carter's policies were deceitful and Sullivan's views were dangerously misguided. And years later, even Brzezinski, Secretary of State for Carter, acknowledged that the political uprising against the Shah had American backing. And this is in the book Power and Principles, published in 1983 on page 356, if somebody wants to check that. And so Brzezinski even admitted that, yes, we, the Americans, were funding and supporting the Ayatollah Khomeini's uprising against the Shah. Bear in mind that the Shah had been a very faithful American ally for 37 years, very faithful, as Ronald Reagan testified too. Well, even Kissinger admitted and documented in The Economist, published in February the 10th, 1979, that it was the American backing of the Ayatollah that ultimately led to the removal of the Shah of Iran from power. So exactly what Jonas Savimbi said, better to be America's enemy than America's ally. Your allies get betrayed and your enemies get bought. The policy miscalculation not only caused the Shah's downfall, but it plunged Iran into chaos and left it a victim of history, to quote from Alexander Haig. Alexander Haig also documented that, yes, no, it was our State Department's miscalculation, he called it, as opposed to deliberate treachery. And then Brzezinski also adds, Carter's State Department was overtly hostile towards the Shah and his government, and in a strange way to treat your allies. But this is because of Jimmy Carter's policies of human rights, where he was taking human rights from the streets in America and putting it into international policy and therefore globalizing the human rights movement. And that's exactly his legacy. We hold our allies to a very high standard, but we are mollycoddling up to our enemies. Carter's the one who sent American wheat to Russia in such great numbers and basically subsidizing it, because he sold the wheat to Russia for less than it cost to produce it in America. And so, you know, America lost on the deal while aiding the Soviet Union so that they would be able to produce more weapons in the arms race, which doesn't make any sense. But Professor Anthony Sutton documented all this in The Best Enemy Money Can Buy. And a lot of that took place during the Carter administration, while Carter was basically funding and subsidizing and aiding the Soviet Union, who was posing the most existential threat to America's survival and existence. And so this continues as you look into even Carter's administration in Sullivan's own memoirs. Sullivan, the treacherous ambassador to Iran, in 1981, Sullivan in his memoirs, page 336, said, America's policies in Iran were delusional. Well, he was a key factor in that delusional foreign policy. And of course, they're all shocked when the Ayatollah turned out to be a worse dictator, a more authoritarian figure, someone who could have thousands of people executed. I mean, a bloodbath. And they called it execute like there was something legal about it, whereas there were effectively arbitrary massacres and basically just having some Mahula decide this person gets put against the wall and shot or hung and so on. And history since recorded Carter's administration as, to quote from Michael Leiden in Failure in Iran, published in 1980, that Carter's administration was confused, hypocritical, and paralyzed in the face of Iran's escalating crisis. And at the height of the turmoil, the Shah was just abandoned, stabbed in the back, given false information. And even Nixon in his book Leaders documented that Jimmy Carter lacked a true understanding of the crisis or its catastrophic consequences, and he failed to make sound decisions. He didn't grasp the irreversible damage his policies caused. And even his Secretary of State Brzezinski writes that in his book. And even Sullivan advised Carter to demand that the Shah must leave Iran immediately and America must align with Khomeini. And there, Jimmy Carter followed his very duplicitous ambassador Sullivan's advice. He demanded the Shah of Iran leave Iran, promised all kinds of things to coax him onto the plane to get out of the country to go to Egypt, and then fully aligned with Khomeini, which is catastrophic. And meanwhile, the American intelligence agencies were described as disorganized and ignoring one another's warnings. And that's according to the French Interior Minister in 1980. But we don't believe it was that accidental. The picture being painted is that the CIA made mistakes and misunderstood, as opposed to being deliberately involved in a concerted campaign and conspiracy to bring down a key American ally, into which America had pumped vast amounts of high-tech weaponry. Iran was seen as a counter, a key part of the Cold War in containing the Soviet Union, and that Iran needed to be strengthened with some of the most advanced American aircraft and F-15 fighter jets and all of that. And all of this was betrayed into the hands of the Ayatollah Khomeini's jihadist crazies. And the CIA failed to predict the 1979 upheavals. They failed to predict the disastrous rise of the Mullahs in Iran, but they were helping to fund it. And they cemented Carter's role as a key figure in this fiasco, disaster, catastrophe, treachery. Jimmy Carter's policies were described in Crime and Punishment by Schaffer as unrealistic, clumsy, short-sighted, indecisive, and full of contradictions, and that it caused global repercussions. I would say that's too kind. In fact, it was treacherous. I think that's the only word you can use, treacherous. And our program on the Sabbateans helps explain where these people are coming from. And Jimmy Carter, of course, was a Council on Foreign Relations Illuminati member. And his treatment of the Shah during the Shah's illness, when the Shah came down with cancer shortly afterwards, was absolutely inhumane. And Jimmy Carter, alone amongst the world leaders, described Khomeini as a sacred figure. This mass-murdering extremist thug as a religious and moderate leader. I mean, those quoting from Jimmy Carter, how can you be so naive and so stupid? It's hard to believe Jimmy Carter was that stupid, that naive. It's more likely that he was just totally and utterly treacherous. And the ties between Khomeini and Carter, even before 1979, became clear to all. And that's according to a BBC report that came out in 2016. Even the BBC could see that Khomeini and Carter were working together. And the Iran Tosia newspaper later published an interview with Giscard d'Estaing, who said the United States rang the death knell for the Shah's rule because Carter had no hope for the regime's survival. And so that was published in 1998 from the French president, Giscard d'Estaing. He looked at it and said, no, there's no doubt about it. Jimmy Carter was the one who sounded the death knell for the Shah's rule. And he had been such a stabilizing influence in the Middle East. So this is the foreign policy legacy of Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter first wrote a pleading letter to the Ayatollah after he initiated the hostage crisis of having his students seize the American embassy. That was a major crisis in 1979. The Iranians seizing the American embassy in Tehran, taking 66 hostages first and humiliating them in public and making them kneel while being blindfolded, handcuffed, and forced to the ground with mock executions, all kinds of tortures, which turned many of them into basket cases to this day from the psychological trauma they went through. But Jimmy Carter's moralizing, cloaked in populism, bordered on naivety. He claimed to act in the name of God, but he appeared out of touch with reality. Although I think that's just a cover. I think the man was deliberately treacherous and has fit the New World Disorder plans of getting rid of stable countries like Iran and replacing them with terror-sponsoring rogue states, failed states at that. And the late Shah criticized Jimmy Carter, claiming his greatest mistake was following American advice. And the Shah's greatest regret was that he listened to America as though America was an ally, and not recognizing that the American allies were actually their main enemy. And it was American advice that led to the release of murderous terrorists that he gave pardons to, who later were orchestrating even more violence. And the Shah very astutely questioned, why is the CIA so intensely active against me? And, you know, that's a good point. The CIA brought about the toppling of the Shah of Iran, and they were funding the whole revolution, and they were undermining and lying to their ally. So the Shah of Iran foresaw the devastating catastrophe which was unfolding, and Jimmy Carter wielded his political and intelligence apparatus to deliberately support the opposition forces and to pressure the Shah into backing down, holding back his military until it was too late. And the CIA director confirmed the Shah's concerns. The CIA director stated later, had we shown more vigilance, America's policy towards Iran's turmoil could have been different. That was published in Newsweek back in 1979, and most certainly America's policy was key. The Shah would not have fallen but for American intervention. The Ayatollah could not have risen to power except with American support. So this isn't a tragedy that was miscalculated. This is a deliberate result of American policies. And so Shafer claims, Carter's presidency was marked by indecision and weakness. His administration was a series of contradictions, errors, and incompetence, leading to global distrust in both his government and in U.S. foreign policy. And that brings me back to our friend Jonas Savimbi of UNITA in Angola, where he said, again, in front of some of our American guests there, if you make a mistake, we're human. We all make mistakes. You make the same mistake twice, you're stupid. You make the same mistake 3, 4, 10, 15, 20 times, you have a hidden agenda. And he's referring to Jimmy Carter's foreign policy. You cannot be that stupid that you make so many mistakes. If Jimmy Carter had just been stupid, he would have done the right thing occasionally just out of sheer accident. But the idea that you can every single time work against your allies and work to support your enemies cannot possibly be an accident. Nobody's that stupid. But it's more serious than that. There are authors who've criticized Carter's populist and controversial behavior, such as Ronald Kessler in Presidential Secret Service. In his chapter on Jimmy Carter, this book, Presidential Secret Service, the author Ronald Kessler speaks about his experiences while he was in the Secret Service protecting prisons. So he's got a chapter on Carter, and he pointed out how, you know, his behavior is so destructive to America's allies. But while Carter's now gone, his policies lived on in what they called Carter II, in other words, Barack Hussein Obama's presidency, and Carter III, Biden's policy. Because Obama and Biden continued Carter's doctrine, Carter's policies regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we can only hope that the death of Carter will mark the end of these very misguided policies and their dark legacy. But the world first faced the rise of Islamic radicalism during Carter's era and the failed battle against terrorism, which continues to this day. And Jimmy Carter authored the book Our Endangered Values, in which he criticized President George W. Bush's disastrous wars in the Middle East. But what he didn't point out is that George Bush was only following the Carter Doctrine, which regarded the Persian Gulf as a vital U.S. interest requiring military intervention to maintain the status quo in the Persian Gulf, basically making the Persian Gulf and states around the Persian Gulf protectorates of America. So George Bush did have a disastrous couple of wars in the Middle East, but he was only following the guidelines started by Jimmy Carter. So it's a bit hypocritical for Carter to criticize George Bush for doing what he in fact started, and which his, you could say, the people he mentored, Obama and Biden, who slavishly followed his policies, have done. Because ideas have consequences. And American foreign policy often affects believers in Africa and the Middle East. And some of the eulogies of Jimmy Carter have claimed that even small acts can change the world, and that Jimmy Carter's actions touched many lives. Now, of course, that is true. And in Jimmy Carter's case, disastrously so. Yes, his acts changed the world, but not for the good. And yes, his actions have touched many lives, but in many cases ended their lives and destroyed what was good in those areas. His intentions may have been good, and I don't believe that, but perhaps his intentions were good. Let's just grant that possibility. But the consequences have been consistently catastrophic. We need to remember it was Jimmy Carter's government's meddling in Afghanistan, early in 1979 that provoked the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan on Christmas Day of that year, 1979, which then provoked the American, a very unbalanced and overreaction of boycotting the Olympics in Moscow in 1980, which really, these poor sportsmen who have trained for years and lifetimes and they've got one shot at it, and then to have their chance shot because of a political decision as a result of political failures, which his meddling caused. Increasingly counterproductive, absolutely disastrous. Politics should stay out of sports, for sure. Well, something else that's come back into news recently started with Jimmy Carter, and that is the Panama Canal. It was Jimmy Carter who decided to give away the Panama Canal. The United States had built the Panama Canal at great cost of many thousands of American lives. America paid a fortune for it many times over. They paid to build it. They later paid the country of Panama for the canal. And then they had to pay over and over for it again and again. And then they gave it away under Jimmy Carter. And now they're paying a fortune in shipping fees, which can be up to $500,000 dollars for toll gate for going through the Panama Canal, which America bought. And now communist China has moved in and seized control over this vital strategic naval choke point. And the trail of betrayal left by Jimmy Carter is staggering. During the 4 years of Jimmy Carter's worthless presidency, 13 countries fell to communism, including Nicaragua, where Carter's administration betrayed their longtime American ally in Nicaragua. And Nicaragua had always voted for America at the United Nations. They had always support America. They were America's ally in so many different ways, and one of America's very few allies who ever paid their war debts to America. Rhodesia was another one that actually paid their war debts to America. All the other countries defaulted and so on. But the Carter administration betrayed their longtime ally. In most cases, these nations didn't just fall to communism, but most of these 13 nations that fell to communism were actually betrayed into the hands of the communist revolutionaries as a direct result of Jimmy Carter's treacherous and inconsistent globalizing of human rights campaign. It was a very high policy goal, foreign policy goal of Jimmy Carter's presidency, to force the people of Rhodesia to hand over to Robert Mugabe's red Chinese trained and red Chinese armed ZANU terrorists. And so the fact that the paradise of Rhodesia has become the hellhole of Zimbabwe is directly a foreign policy achievement of Jimmy Carter. That's part of his presidential legacy. Americans removed Jimmy Carter from his presidency over 44 years ago. However, the long-suffering people of Zimbabwe are still stuck with Carter's legacy in the form of Robert Mugabe's murderous Marxist dictatorship, now in the hand of his hand-picked successor, Mnangagwa, and the ZANU-PF dictatorship. And just as the long-suffering people of Iran are still oppressed by the Ayatollahs, who, by the way, are provoking another war in the Middle East, and that's another long-time legacy of Jimmy Carter's. But not one country fell to communism during the 8 years of Ronald Reagan's presidency. In fact, countries started to be freed from communist oppression, and Ronald Reagan put freedom on the offensive. He supported resistance movements in communist countries that actually helped win the Cold War and helped bring down the Berlin Wall and collapse the Iron Curtain. The collapse of communism throughout Eastern Europe in 1989 brought about a new era of religious freedom and missionary activity that had previously been inconceivable. And I was right at the heart of that, so I know how that worked. And I was in Angola working with Jonas Savimbi's freedom fighters, doing chaplaincy work amongst them, when we had a bad day of being bombed and strafed. And fortunately, the communists only operate during daytime. They didn't have night fighting capabilities at that stage. So we were gathered around a campfire and heating up tea and hot chocolate and so on, and listening to the BBC World Service on shortwave radio. And on came Ronald Reagan. And it was quite an experience to hear. It was extraordinary to suddenly hear Ronald Reagan speaking on shortwave radio. And we actually heard his speech. "We are going to send Stinger missiles to the needs of freedom fighters in Angola." And we were astounded. I mean, it's like sitting in a cinema and the person on the screen starts talking about you and your situation. Quite remarkable. There was a long silence as we sat in stunned amazement. We wondered if our ears had actually heard what we thought we'd heard. And then one said, well, that would be nice, but will they do it? And we scarcely dared believe it would be possible, but it did happen. And not long afterwards, Stinger missiles began to arrive in UNITA-controlled Free Angola, and Soviet aircraft were shot down, and the bombing and strafing of villages and schools and churches in Angola came to an end. And without any doubt, Ronald Reagan's policy saved many tens of thousands of lives in Angola. And I have in my photo albums and in my book, Behind Enemy Lines for Christ, numerous pictures of Soviet aircraft shot down in Angola. MI-24 Hind helicopter gunships, the MI-8 HIP helicopters, MiG-23. These are a reminder of an American president actually cared about the people of Angola, those who were suffering under communist occupation. So I'm grateful for the role of Ronald Reagan in saving lives in Angola, where over 50,000 Cuban troops were attacking and destroying many churches, and they were strafing and terrorizing villages in Angola, which we documented. But while there are millions today who are alive because of Ronald Reagan's far-sighted, courageous foreign policies, there are millions of people today who are dead or are oppressed as a result of Jimmy Carter's very disastrous, catastrophic policies. And I think that's so important for us to know. One politician once said, there's nothing the communists despise more than weakness. There's nothing they respect more than strength. Well, America was plainly despised in the days of Jimmy Carter, especially when they absolutely bungled the hostage rescue attempt in Iran. That was catastrophic failure. Do you think that a superpower was humbled by these Ayatollah, backward, Middle Ages, Dark Ages type of characters in Iran? And America could not bring about an effective rescue effort, like Francis Krupanoin's successful rescue of their hostages in Somalia back in 1976, where GSG-9 saved all of their hostages without one loss at all, killed all of the terrorists who were holding their people hostage. And you think of how even Israeli Defense Force rescuing their hostages who were being held in Uganda back in 1976, and yet America couldn't rescue their hostages in 1980 who were in Iran. And so America was despised under Carter. And during the Clinton era, we witnessed a steady increase of violent persecution of Christians in the Muslim world, which had been unleashed by the betrayal of the Shah of Iran and destabilizing influence that they had been. And now these radicals under the Ayatollahs were sponsoring more and more terrorism. And that included the National Islamic Front government in Sudan, who began systematic terror bombing campaigns of churches, hospitals, and schools, which I experienced. I was personally targeted by bombing, aerial bombardments while ministering in churches and schools and hospitals in Sudan. But as America began to fight back after terror attacks of September 11th in 2001, with the toppling of the radical Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and we suddenly saw the bombing of churches in northern Nigeria and South Sudan stopped, and we actually enjoyed a period of relative peace, actual stability, as radical Muslim regimes backed off in the sign of resurgent American military activity. But as Obama became president of America in 2009, there was an unmistakable escalation of violent attacks on Christians worldwide, particularly in the Muslim Middle East. And literally hundreds of churches were bombed and burned throughout northern Nigeria and Egypt and Sudan and Iraq in those years under Obama. And just in northern Nigeria alone, in just a five-year period alone, from 2010 to 2015, there were 1,000 terrorist attacks on churches in northern Nigeria, 17,000 Christians killed in northern Nigeria by Boko Haram jihadist terrorists. And that's just one example of how Barack Hussein Obama unleashed an explosion of persecution in church with his foreign policy activities. Now, I was at a biblical worldview conference in Colorado in 2010. And one of the speakers claimed that Barack Hussein Obama is the worst president in American history. Well, during discussion time, I ventured to challenge this, pointing out it may turn out to be so, but he's only been in power for less than 2 years. Had this man considered the trail of treachery of President Jimmy Carter? And while I was cataloging some of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy catastrophes, especially in my home country of Rhodesia, Dr. David Noble walked up and put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Peter, you're wrong. When it comes to damage done No president of America was worse than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He betrayed the whole of Eastern Europe, ultimately a third of the world's population, under the most oppressive dictatorship in history, the Soviet Union. Well, that's just a good point. I just think, yeah, FDR, absolute catastrophe too. And President Herbert Hoover documented that in Freedom Betrayed, the catastrophe of FDR's policies in the Second World War and after it. And fair enough. Well, from the back of the hall, a loud voice rang out, and it all began with Abraham Lincoln. And then another person from another section of the hall shouted out, Woodrow Wilson should also be considered as a serious candidate for one of the worst presidents in American history. After all, Woodrow Wilson introduced federal income tax, the Federal Reserve Bank, dragged America into the First World War, and played a leading role in launching the League of Nations, a major Council on Foreign Relations, Illuminati insider of insiders. And that was thoughtful too. So who's the worst president in American history? Many people today are saying Biden. Well, you know, he's certainly been inept and useless. But in terms of damage done, he can't come close to the damage done by Obama and Franklin Delano Roosevelt or even Woodrow Wilson. And as that other person pointed out, and all started with Abraham Lincoln, who's an American idol. He's got an actual temple set up for him on the mall. And when you go into this massive temple, it actually says, in this temple, as in the hearts of a people for whom he saved the Union, Abraham Lincoln will live forever. I mean, absolutely idolatrous. This is hagiography. This is really talking of your departed president like he's a saint. No, more like a god. And that also brings up a point that I've had some people point out, that it seems that the only good president, only good politician is a dead one. During their lives, you hear scandals, crisis, catastrophe, how terrible they are while they're alive. The moment they die, it's like they enter the pantheon of gods, and suddenly they are converted into some kind of departed god, and you cannot question them, and they'll build outsized monuments and even temples for them in the case of Lincoln. Well, I've got more to add than this. On the 9th of July, 2011, the youngest country in the world was born, South Sudan. And this was a monumental answer to prayer for us, because I had worked long and hard in South Sudan to seek to bring about the independence of South Sudan. I had campaigned for the independence of South Sudan and even had arguments with Commander Salva Kiir, who's now the first president of South Sudan. As recently as 2001, Salva Kiir was arguing with me that independence is a good idea, but it's impossible. The African Union has never agreed to redrawing the maps that were drawn up first in Berlin in the Berlin Conference of 1884, and they're not willing to draw the maps according to geographic, ethnic, or according to ethno-linguistic concerns. And I was saying, but you have to redraw the map, because you will continue to be an oppressed Christian black minority in an Arab Muslim country unless you redraw the map where you are the majority in South Sudan. Then you could be a free and independent country. Well, on the 9th of July 2011, South Sudan was born, the first departure from the Berlin Conference maps drawn back in 1884. So that was a major answer to prayer. But Jimmy Carter ruined this in so many ways. He sowed the seeds of civil war in South Sudan, because as Salva Kiir was arguing for, we need to be declared a Christian country and have a Christian constitution. And Jimmy Carter says, no. You must be a secular state. You can't have a Christian state. You can't even have a minute of silence. This must be a completely secular state. And so the elder statesman, this highly respected ex-president of America, Jimmy Carter, was advising them not only to be a secular state, but to have the United Nations provide their textbooks to their schools. So the whole idea of having South Sudan as a Christian country was being sabotaged right at the beginning. We were having a, you could say, miscarriage rather than a proper birth of South Sudan. And Jimmy Carter then sowed the seeds of the next civil war in South Sudan by telling Salva Kiir, the president, that he must have Riek Machar as his vice president. Now, Riek Machar was more than a rival. He was an enemy of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. He had been a surrogate for the Arabs, and his SSIM that he ran, the South Sudan Independence Movement, had been a surrogate for the National Islamic Front government. They were armed and trained by the government. In fact, they had killed Mor Dinka, and destroyed more cattle and done more scorched earth in South Sudan than even the Arab North. And so to make Riek Machar the vice president, which Jimmy Carter said would bring about unity and all of that sort of thing, he thought that's a good idea. And Silva Kiir later regretted that he ever took Jimmy Carter's advice, because at the end of their first year of independence, President Riek Machar, President Silva Kiir had to inform the people at Tiasoit, inform them that billions of Sudanese pounds had been embezzled and were missing from corruption. I think it was 5 billion Sudanese pounds, which was equal to a British pound at the beginning of independence, although it did devalue later, was missing. And where could that have been from? Well, Riek Machar, the vice president, was in charge of the oil production and oil export. It could have only been him that is responsible, because that's most of the funds that they had, was being embezzled. And this led to a civil war when the president tried to sack his entire government and start afresh because of the corruption and the money not being returned. This led to civil war. And this happened several times, that they would come to a point of agreement, and over and over again, the U.S. State Department, now under Obama, would be pushing, no, you've got to bring Riek Machar back in. And this just was unworkable. He's the most corrupt vice president, and the country is being undermined. So again, you could see this Jimmy Carter legacy. When he was doing good things, like building houses for Habitat for Humanity and involved in some good charity work, he was also undermining peace, justice, and human rights in the name of advancing peace, justice, and human rights. And so Jimmy Carter is a case of what the Bible says, that the compassions of the wicked are cruel. And there's no doubt millions of people died throughout Africa, Asia, and the Middle East because of the foreign policies of Jimmy Carter. And tens of millions continue to suffer to this day as a result of the Carter foreign policy legacy, including the people of Iran and Zimbabwe, of course. And it's to be remembered, the Shah of Iran was one of America's closest allies in the Middle East when Jimmy Carter's State Department actively worked to betray the ally and push Iran over to the Ayatollahs. And the end result of that has yet to be seen. Iran continues to be a volatile part of this extremely volatile and violent Middle East. But we should also add that the devastating so-called Arab Spring, launched by the U.S. State Department of Barack Hussein Obama, or what was called Carter II, toppled stable governments throughout the Middle East and initiated a wave of destructive riots, revolutions, and terrorism, which brought the number of Christians in the Middle East down from 15 million in 2010 to less than 10 million by 2020. So in 5 years, we lost 5 million Christians in the Muslim Middle East. And most of those Christians had been in Egypt, in Iraq, and in Syria, which is the latest to be betrayed under American foreign policy following the Carter Doctrine. So Obama's Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, described the Muslim Brotherhood as a force for peace and moderation in the Middle East. This despite the Muslim Brotherhood having been responsible for the very public assassination of President Anwar Sadat of Egypt, who, by the way, was the real architect of the Camp David peace accord between Egypt and Israel, which Jimmy Carter received credit for. And on just one weekend, the Muslim Brotherhood mobilized mobs that burned down 70 churches in Egypt. Some of them churches that stood for 1,000 years and more. And founded and funded by the CIA, ISIS beheaded countless Christians, blew up historic monuments, including the tombs of Daniel and Jonah and other Old Testament prophets. And during Obama's disastrous presidency, a billboard appeared in America with a smiling picture of President Jimmy Carter declaring, well, at least I can't be called America's worst president anymore. And that's actually true. Jimmy Carter was bad, but Jimmy Carter II, or Obama, was worse. And Jimmy Carter III, or Biden, has proved to be maybe even worse. But this is where we are right now. We are looking at rewriting of history, that a failed, disastrous president can now be eulogized. And it's like people are just forgetting history, and they're obviously forgetting the many millions of persecuted Christians who've died as a result of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy. And I just wish people would have a memory. It does seem that The only good politician is the dead one. While they're alive, you hear about the disasters they cause, and when they're dead, they enter this pantheon of American gods where they somehow are like the Caesars of Rome, suddenly lifted up and immortalized in some kind of marble, and you're not allowed to criticize them anymore. So I'm sure that this is a very politically incorrect and unpopular program, Andrew. I know you don't mind, but people around the world are, I think, giving a different narrative. We're not in step with this mantra of, you know, what a great president and what a lovely person. And, you know, Jimmy Carter claimed to be born again, and he did teach a Sunday school, and he certainly built a lot of houses for the homeless in Habitat for Humanity. And that's good, but that doesn't make up for the lives ruined by hideous policies, which was, to quote our good friend Jonas Limby, buying your enemies and selling your friends. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Thank I'll just mute you for a second while our audio catches up. You know what happens, ladies and gentlemen, on Skype when one of us talks for a period of time. When Peter emailed me his show title for today's show yesterday, I was very excited about it because the news had just come out. I'm not very familiar with the Carter presidency. I know someone who probably is, my good friend Mark Dankoff, whose father, Colonel Dankoff, actually went over as some sort of security consultant to the Shah of Iran. So I'll certainly be emailing the show over to Mark to see if there's anything in there that he's unaware of. But it's, as you say, Peter, we see it all the time. These people, whatever criticism they get during their lives, it's all brushed under the carpet. It's almost like sainthood that they get. The only one even Nixon, who they held out to be the worst president ever and dishonest and all these sorts of things. When you actually look into Nixon a little bit more, some interesting facts emerge of who he was going to expose and why, and then you can probably understand why he's one of the most demonized presidents. But even him, I think all the presidents turn out for the funeral, so it's almost like all the surviving presidents rather, so it's almost like an unwritten rule that whatever goes on, you all, you know, get together and brush it under the carpet when they pass on. And the other thing, of course, I'm reminded of Winston Churchill when he died at a very old age, as did Carter. So it seems the more evil you do, the longer you get to live on this planet. And of course, it's no coincidence that in the Bible, Satan is called a prince of this planet. Any thoughts on that, Peter?
Yes, it does seem to be so. And of course, the Sabbateans are meant to also be taking blood from young people and having blood transfusions to give them longer life. And there's all kinds of immoral things being done. It's also as though, you know, the devil doesn't even want them. It is the amount of evil people, like, just think of Kissinger, how long he lived. And there are quite a few of these Sabbateans involved in the Illuminati, the whole, what do they call it? They have this Bohemian Grove and so on, celebrations. They're a bunch of occultists and often involved in child abuse and so on. I'm not saying that Carter was going that far, but he certainly was part of the whole Council on Foreign Relations and part of this whole inner circle of the deep state. Amazing, when he was elected, they called him an outsider. He was not an outsider. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Outsiders were Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. They are outsiders. They're not parts of the in-group. Jimmy Carter was a total insider. And who did he employ? Bear in mind, policy is personnel is policy. And he employed people like Warren Christopher and General Haig, and he had people like Brzezinski. He was a consummate insider, and he was networked with all these folks who are what we now call a deep state. And so Jimmy Carter is going to be eulogized by those people because he's one of them. But I am very disappointed that people I would have thought have got more discernment praising Jimmy Carter. And yes, okay, he did build some nice houses. But aside from being a humanitarian post-president, the catastrophe caused through his presidential policies, the betrayal of Rhodesia and the betrayal of Aaron just alone are some of the worst things. But then he also signed the SALT agreement, which was basically a de-escalating the arms race and putting America at a disadvantage with the Soviet Union. One of Ronald Reagan's policies was to renounce the SALT agreement, which had been done by the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, which Carter signed with Brezhnev. And people need to remember these facts, because a president is more than just a personal individual. They represent policies. They represent the whole country and much more. So I am deeply concerned over this dishonesty of people who wanting to eulogize and lift up. And it's actually deify in many ways, make him an idol, just like has been done with Abraham Lincoln and Stalin and Mandela in South Africa and Mao Zedong. You can mention all the way through to Martin Luther King, Winston Churchill. They've all been lifted up to almost deified status, and you're not even allowed to bring up the facts. The facts are very inconvenient, and you're meant to leave the facts out, because at this point you're just meant to eulogize. As was well said, the only good president, the only good politician is a dead politician. You know how you can tell when a politician lies? His lips move. And when he dies, he lies still. And so the difference between organized crime and the government is organized crime is organized. And the difference between between the government and the mafia is the mafia turns a profit. And so you could continue. I mean, we must stop idolizing politicians and realize they're not the solution, they are the problem. Back to you, Andrew.
It's funny you say that, Peter, because there is a guy on YouTube who was a former boss in the Colombo family, I believe. His name is Michael Franzese, and he found Christ when he was in prison, and he's now a public speaker. He has a radio show, and he has a book as well, and it's all about comparing the mafia to government and how government really are the big mafia. And I've listened to, he's done some very interesting shows over, the last year or so that I found him, and I always check him out on a daily basis. He's got a YouTube channel, so it's worth having a look down there. There is indeed one show. I'll see if I can find a show there. I mention it because what you said about, organised crime, the similarities, that's what came straight to mind. So I'm loading it up now. I hope nothing starts playing that we don't want, but there was certainly a show that I recall I believe the Biden family should be indicted for mob-like racketeering under RICO, the family ties that run America, secret connections exposed. He's got a book called Mafia Democracy, and I think that there's something even so there's a couple of things there that he talks about, and coming from somebody like that, who's been in that life, it's very interesting. Before we go, could you let the audience know, that's important, folks, every year the Great Commission course is run by Frontline Fellowship, Peter's missionary ministry, and every year it's more of a struggle because the financial situation unfortunately does not get better. However, you can help at this time of year. In the post for this show, you will see a Give, Send, Go link right underneath where the link was, where you download the show, that you can actually send Peter some money to help. Please support Peter, but also at this critical time of year, the Great Commission course. What can you tell us about this, Peter?
Yes, in fact, I think this even ties in with what you're talking about. Interestingly, the more successful our mission gets, the more we suffer financially. For example, we a mission to the persecuted church. We serve in restricted access areas, smuggling Bibles, helping behind enemy lines, like helping the UNITA freedom fighters in Angola, the RENAMO freedom fighters in Mozambique, the anti-communist guerrillas, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army in Sudan. Well, every success leads to a massive decrease in support. For example, 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down and the Iron Curtain collapsed, it's like our support dried up and disappeared, as though, oh, we don't need missions to the communist world or anti-communist missions anymore because communism is dead. And, well, we had the greatest opportunities for ministry suddenly. All of the Eastern Europe was open for the gospel, even Russian. We were able to do work that we had never been able to do before and get more Bibles in. And suddenly all the funding for Bible printing and so on disappeared. Well, we painstakingly built up our support again, and then 1994, South Africa was betrayed into the hands of the communists, and there's people saying, well, the lights have gone out, South Africa's gone, and suddenly, being a South Africa-based mission, our support dried up, and we had to start again to rebuild painstakingly. And then in the year 2011, when South Sudan got its independence, it's like our support disappeared again. And, well, you know, who needs the mission to Sudan anymore, because they're free, they're independent. And, well, there was so much more that needed to be done, leadership training, textbooks, chaplain's handbooks, all sorts of things we had to do. And we could do it, but suddenly there was no funds to do it. And then, of course, 2009, we had this, 2008, we had this worthless derivatives, economic crash, and so many people lost their jobs, and that was terrible. We built up our support again in 2020. It's like it collapsed during the lockdown lunacy. Well, I mean, many people lost their jobs and incomes and investments, and so understandable, missions is not the highest priority in most people's lives. But we are working in a world war of worldviews. We work in this clash of civilizations, and it's so important to have conservative Christian anti-communist ministries that are thinking of rebuilding Christian civilization and the culture wars, which is what our biblical worldview summits and Great Commission course is so much part of. Literature, leadership training, all of these things are key parts of our work, and we are involved in making a difference in universities, in the media, and all of this. So it's so sad to see there's so much we can do. We have so many open doors to us, but it's like our support keeps disappearing. The more successful we get, the more our support disappears. And it's a tragic. I don't think many people see the importance of a faith mission like ours and how we can make such an impact. But I'd recommend listeners who might be interested to visit our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org, and see the different projects we're involved in. And we've got Give, Send, Goes to help on that. Of course, it doesn't help that the South African government has destroyed our postal service. The South African postal service has collapsed, so we've got to do more things online. We used to live off checks being sent in the mail to us, and that disappeared when the post office collapsed. More than that, South African government now refuses to allow banks to cash checks. So we've got to do things more and more electronically. I suppose it's more for them to be able to keep track of what's going on. But we have people coming over the years from literally all over the world coming to our Great Commission courses. We've had people from as far afield as New Zealand and Canada and Australia, from Switzerland, Russia, Germany, Ireland, literally from all over Africa, coming from Sudan and Kenya and Nigeria, and able to invest in leaders, leadership training, literature distribution, printing projects. And we've got wonderful challenges and opportunities coming up, but we are hamstrung, frustrated, often starved of the funds needed to just operate. We've sometimes been unable to purchase electricity to keep things going. We've sometimes been without water because of problems with paying municipal water bills. So we are struggling for some basic things, but our mission has been having successes in the field, great missions this year. We've even got one of our missionaries working right in the Congo, the heart of darkness right now. I've been Swaziland, Zambia, Oranje, Eswatini, Zululand this last year, ministered on occasions to thousands of people at a single conference or meeting, and distributed tons of Bibles. In fact, more than 100 tons of Bibles and books this year. More coming, and we literally are struggling for how we're going to pay for the transportation of containers of Bibles and books that have been donated to us. And they paid for to get to Cape Town Harbor, but just to get a container of 4 million gospel booklets that's sitting in the harbor, and we've got to move it over to our Livingston House Mission headquarters. You know, that takes money too. We're tax exempt on these things, but we still have expenses to clear it through customs and to bring it all the way through to where we are and in the distributions. So if people are interested in helping with some of the upcoming projects, we've got some great anti-communist books needing funding that we can print them, like Resistance and Reformation in Romania, which is a fascinating expose on how during the Cold War people were able to resist the communists effectively and survive. And so that's quite a wonderful book. There's the Great Commission Handbook, basically how to change the world, which we want to give to people in Bible colleges and to people who attend our Great Commission course. We've got a camp and course coming now with people who want to come, capable leaders, but they can't afford even the nominal expense. You know, there's obviously catering and other expenses. The lectures are free, but there's catering and accommodation that needs to be covered, and transportation to get people to where the different outreaches are taking place. So if anyone wants to help sponsor some worthy students or sponsor some printings or some of our work, the cost of fuel is exceeding all previous expectations, and we've got to be able to travel to do a lot of our ministry. And of course, vehicles need repairs, and there's printing costs for Bibles and books. So please visit www.frontlinemissionsa.org or email mission@frontline.org.za or ZA. And if you go onto our website, you'll see some of the projects, our annual report, our update, prayer and praise update, the book Frontline Behind Enemy Lines for Christ. You can also get hold of it by ebook or print on demand because of the logistical challenges of mailing these things. We even have a North American office now with a pre-positioned quite a lot of our books, like Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam, and other books like that. People can get from our North American office. So people don't need to think that everything is out of range. And then anywhere in the world, one can order the prints on demand or ebooks. So please do help us. We are in a battle, and we've got many enemies and a lot of sabotage and threats. We've got to think security and be alert at all times. We are living in a volatile continent, but we are winning the war in many ways, in that there's already 680 million Christians in Africa, and yet only 150 million have Bibles. So 500 million churchgoers in Africa don't even have a Bible. And we are trying to supply Bibles and leadership training. Most pastors in Africa have no Bible college training, and so we try to provide leadership training for people in the field. And you know how many of the colleges and universities are absolutely corrupt, infiltrated, and disastrous. So it's important to have conservative, traditional Christian, biblical, founded on the rock, the five solas of the Reformation, none of the modern, woke, liberal nonsense. And as you know, the bad guys get lots and lots of support from governments and so on. But groups like ours that are politically incorrect, we just get character assassins trying to blow up bridges of support and undermine our work through spreading lies and slander and doing everything they can to sabotage our effectiveness. So thank you so much, Andrew, and we do appreciate any prayers and support listeners can offer.
Thank you so much, Peter. Yes, please support Frontline Fellowship, folks. I said after I stopped taking donations back in June of last year that please direct any support to Frontline Fellowship. Okay, so that being said, Peter, as I said earlier, he will be back on the show 4 weeks from today, which I believe is Tuesday the 28th of January. I'm going to be back with you all tomorrow for a special show of the Saturday I'm Talking To You show. I'm going to record it and broadcast it tomorrow. Hopefully by then my voice will be a bit better, aiming for a full recovery. But until then, I want to thank Peter so much for joining us today for a presentation entitled The Real Story of Jimmy Carter's Disastrous Foreign Policy Legacy. I want to thank all of you for listening. Have a happy new year, and bye for now.